Chapter 7. "Having a doze," said Divine. "A bit blasé about new planets by now?"
"Can you see anything?" interrupted Weston.
"I can't manage the shutters, damn them," returned Divine. "We may as well get to the manhole."
Ransom awoke from his brown study. The two partners were working together close beside him in the semi-darkness. He was cold, and his body, though in fact much lighter than on Earth, still felt intolerably heavy. But a vivid sense of his situation returned to him. Some fear, but more curiosity. It might mean death, but what a scaffold! Already cold air was coming in from without, and light. He moved his head impatiently to catch some glimpse between the labouring shoulders of the two men. A moment later the last nut was unscrewed. He was looking out through the manhole. Naturally enough, all he saw was the ground. A circle of pale pink, almost of white. Whether very close and short vegetation, or very wrinkled and granulated rock or soil, he could not say. Instantly the dark shape of Divine filled the aperture, and Ransom had time to notice that he had a revolver in his hand. "For me, or for Saunz, or for both?" he wondered.
"You next," said Weston curtly.
Ransom took a deep breath, and his hand went to the knife beneath his belt. Then he got his head and shoulders through the manhole, his two hands on the soil of Malacandra. The pink stuff was soft and faintly resilient, like India rubber, clearly vegetation. Instantly Ransom looked up. He saw a pale blue sky. A fine winter morning sky it would have been on Earth. A great billowy cumulus mass of rose colour lower down, which he took for a cloud, and then,
"Get out,"
said Weston from behind him. He scrambled through and rose to his feet. The air was cold, but not bitterly so, and it seemed a little rough at the back of his throat. He gazed about him, and the very intensity of his desire to take in the new world at a glance defeated itself. He saw nothing but colours, colours that refused to form themselves into things. Moreover, he knew nothing yet well enough to see it. You cannot see things till you know roughly what they are. His first impression was of a bright, pale world, a warm paint box. A moment later he recognized the flat belt of light blue as a sheet of water, or of something like water, which came nearly to his feet. They were on the shore of a lake or river.
"Now then," said Weston, brushing past him.
He turned and saw, to his surprise, a quite recognizable object in the immediate foreground, a hut of unmistakably terrestrial pattern, though built of strange materials.
"They're human?" he gasped. "They build houses?"
"We do," said Divine. "Guess again."
And producing a key from his pocket, proceeded to unlock a very ordinary padlock on the door of the hut. With a not very clearly defined feeling of disappointment or relief, Ransom realized that his captors were merely returning to their own camp. They behaved as one might have expected. They walked into the hut, let down the slats which served for windows, sniffed the close air, expressed surprise that they had left it so dirty, and presently re-emerged.
"We'd better see about the stores," said Weston.
Ransom soon realized that he was to have little leisure for observation, and no opportunity of escape. The monotonous work of transferring food, clothes, weapons, and many unidentifiable packages from the ship to the hut kept him vigorously occupied for the next hour or so, and in the closest contact with his kidnappers. But something he learned. Before anything else, he learned that Malacandra was beautiful. And he even reflected how odd it was that this possibility had never entered into his speculations about it. The same peculiar twist of imagination which led him to people the universe with monsters had somehow taught him to expect nothing on a strange planet except rocky desolation, or else a network of nightmare machines. He could not say why, now that he came to think of it. He also discovered that the blue water surrounded them on at least three sides. His view in the fourth direction was blotted out by the vast steel football in which they had come. The hut, in fact, was built either on the point of a peninsula or on the end of an island. He also came little by little to the conclusion that the water was not merely blue in certain lights, like terrestrial water, but really blue. There was something about its behavior under the very gentle breeze which puzzled him. Something wrong or unnatural about the waves. For one thing, they were too big for such a wind. But that was not the whole secret. They reminded him somehow of the water that he had seen shooting up under the impact of shells in pictures of naval battles. Then suddenly realization came to him. They were the wrong shape, out of drawing, far too high for their length, too narrow at the base, too steep in the sides. He was reminded of something he had read in one of those modern poets about a sea rising in turreted walls.
"Catch!" shouted Divine.
Ransom caught and hurled the parcel on to Weston at the hut door. On one side the water extended a long way, about a quarter of a mile, he thought, but perspective was still difficult in the strange world. On the other side it was much narrower, not wider than 15 feet, perhaps, and seemed to be flowing over a shallow, broken and swirling water that made a softer and more hissing sound than water on earth, and where it washed the hither bank, the pinkish-white vegetation went down to the very brink, there was a bubbling and sparkling which suggested effervescence. He tried hard, in such stolen glances as the work allowed him, to make something out of the farther shore. A mass of something purple, so huge that he took it for a heather-covered mountain, was his first impression. On the other side, beyond the larger water, there was something of the same kind. But there he could see over the top of it. Beyond were strange upright shapes of whitish green, too jagged and irregular for buildings, too thin and steep for mountains. Beyond and above these again was the rose-coloured cloud-like mass. It might really be a cloud, but it was very solid-looking, and did not seem to have moved since he first set eyes on it from the manhole. It looked like the top of a gigantic red cauliflower, or like a huge bowl of red soapsuds, and it was exquisitely beautiful in tint and shape. Baffled by this, he turned his attention to the nearer shore beyond the shallows. The purple mass looked for a moment like a clump of organ pipes, then like a stack of rolls of cloth set up on end, then like a forest of gigantic umbrellas blown inside out. It was in faint motion. Suddenly his eyes mastered the object. The purple stuff was vegetation. More precisely, it was vegetables. Vegetables about twice the height of English elms, but apparently soft and flimsy. The stalks, one could hardly call them trunks, rose smooth and round, and surprisingly thin, for about 40 feet. Above that, the huge plants opened into sheaf-like development, not of branches, but of leaves. Leaves large as lifeboats, but nearly transparent. The whole thing corresponded roughly to his idea of a submarine forest. The plants, at once so large and so frail, seemed to need water to support them, and he wondered that they could hang in the air. Lower down, between the stems, he saw the vivid purple twilight, mottled with paler sunshine, which made up the internal scenery of the wood.
"Time for lunch," said Divine suddenly.
Ransom straightened his back. In spite of the thinness and coldness of the air, his forehead was moist. They had been working hard, and he was short of breath. Weston appeared from the door of the hut and muttered something about finishing first. Divine, however, overruled him. A tin of beef and some biscuits were produced, and the men sat down on the various boxes which were still plentifully littered between the spaceship and the hut. Some whiskey, again at Divine's suggestion and against Weston's advice, was poured into the tin cups and mixed with water. The latter, Ransom noticed, was drawn from their own water tins and not from the blue lakes. As often happens, the cessation of bodily activity drew Ransom's attention to the excitement under which he had been labouring ever since their landing. Eating seemed almost out of the question. Mindful, however, of a possible dash for liberty, he forced himself to eat very much more than usual, and appetite returned as he ate. He devoured all that he could lay hands on, either of food or drink, and the taste of that first meal was ever after associated in his mind with the first unearthly strangeness, never fully recaptured, of the bright, still, sparkling, unintelligible landscape, with needling shapes of pale green thousands of feet high, with sheets of dazzling blue soda water and acres of rose-red soapsuds. He was a little afraid that his companions might notice and suspect his new achievements as a trencherman, but their attention was otherwise engaged. Their eyes never ceased roving the landscape. They spoke abstractedly and often changed position, and were ever looking over their shoulders. Ransom was just finishing his protracted meal when he saw Divine stiffen like a dog and lay his hand in silence on Weston's shoulder. Both nodded. They rose. Ransom, gulping down the last of his whiskey, rose too. He found himself between his two captors. Both revolvers were out. They were edging him to the shore of the narrow water, and they were looking and pointing across it. At first he could not see clearly what they were pointing at. There seemed to be some paler and slenderer plants than he had noticed before amongst the purple ones. He hardly attended to them, for his eyes were busy searching the ground, so obsessed was he with the reptile fears and insect fears of modern imagining. It was the reflections of the new white objects in the water that sent his eyes back to them. Long, streaky white reflections, motionless in the running water. Four or five, no, to be precise, six of them. He looked up. Six white things were standing there. Spindly and flimsy things, twice or three times the height of a man. His first idea was that they were images of men, the work of savage artists. He had seen things like them in books of archaeology. But what could they be made of, and how could they stand? So crazily thin and elongated in the leg, so top-heavily pouted in the chest, such stalky, flexible-looking distortions of earthly bipeds, like something seen in one of those comic mirrors. They were certainly not made of stone or metal, for now they seemed to sway a little as he watched. Now, with a shock that chased the blood from his cheeks, he saw that they were alive, that they were moving, that they were coming at him. He had a momentary scared glimpse of their faces, thin and unnaturally long, with long drooping noses and drooping mouths of half-spectral, half-idiotic solemnity. Then he turned wildly to fly, and found himself gripped by Divine. "Let me go!" he cried. "Don't be a fool," hissed Divine, offering the muzzle of his pistol. Then, as they struggled, one of the things sent its voice across the water to them, an enormous horn-like voice far above their heads. "They want us to go across," said Weston. Both the men were forcing him to the water's edge. He planted his feet, bent his back, and resisted donkey fashion. Now the other two were both in the water, pulling him, and he was still on the land. He found that he was screaming. Suddenly a second, much louder and less articulate noise broke from the creatures on the far bank. Weston shouted too, relaxed his grip on Ransom, and suddenly fired his revolver, not across the water, but up it. Ransom saw why at the same moment. A line of foam, like the track of a torpedo, was speeding towards them, and in the midst of it some large, shining beast. Divine shrieked a curse, slipped and collapsed into the water. Ransom saw a snapping jaw between them, and heard the deafening noise of Weston's revolver again and again beside him, and, almost as loud, the clamour of the monsters on the far bank, who seemed to be taking to the water, too. He had had no need to make a decision. The moment he was free, he had found himself automatically darting behind his captors, then behind the spaceship, and on, as fast as his legs could carry him, into the utterly unknown beyond it. As he rounded the metal sphere, a wild confusion of blue, purple, and red met his eyes. He did not slacken his pace for a moment's inspection. He found himself splashing through water, and crying out not with pain, but with surprise, because the water was warm. In less than a minute he was climbing out onto dry land again. He was running up a steep incline. And now he was running through purple shadow between the stems of another forest of the huge plants. Chapter 8. A month of inactivity, a heavy meal, and an unknown world do not help a man to run. Half an hour later, Ransom was walking, not running, through the forest, with a hand pressed to his aching side and his ears strained for any noise of pursuit. The clamour of revolver shots and voices behind him, not all human voices, had been succeeded first by rifle shots and calls at long intervals, and then by utter silence. As far as eye could reach, he saw nothing but the stems of the great plants about him receding in the violet shade, and far overhead the multiple transparency of huge leaves filtering the sunshine to the solemn splendour of twilight in which he walked. Whenever he felt able, he ran again. The ground continued soft and springy, covered with the same resilient weed which was the first thing his hands had touched in Malacandra. Once or twice a small red creature scuttled across his path, but otherwise there seemed to be no life stirring in the wood. Nothing to fear, except the fact of wandering unprovisioned and alone in a forest of unknown vegetation thousands or millions of miles beyond the reach or knowledge of man. But Ransom was thinking of Sorns, for doubtless those were the Sorns, those creatures they had tried to give him to. They were quite unlike the horrors his imagination had conjured up, and for that reason had taken him off his guard. They appealed away from the Wellsian fantasies to an earlier, almost an infantile complex of fears. Giants, ogres, ghosts, skeletons, those were its key words. Spooks on stilts, he said to himself, surrealistic bogeymen with their long faces. at the same time the descent away from him. The idea of suicide was now far from his mind. Instead, he was determined to back his luck to the end. He prayed, and he felt his knife. He felt a strange emotion of confidence and affection towards himself. He checked himself on the point of saying, "We'll stick to one another." The ground became worse and interrupted his meditation. He had been going gently upwards for some hours with steeper ground on his right, apparently half-scaling, half-skirting a hill. His path now began to cross a number of ridges, spurs doubtless of the higher ground on the right. He did not know why he should cross them, but for some reason he did. Possibly a vague memory of earthly geography suggested that the lower ground would open out to bare places between wood and water, where sawns would be more likely to catch him. As he continued crossing ridges and gullies, he was struck with their extreme steepness, but somehow they were not very difficult to cross. He noticed, too, that even the smallest hummocks of earth were of an unearthly shape, too narrow, too pointed at the top, and too small at the base. He remembered that the waves on the blue lakes had displayed a similar oddity, and, glancing up at the purple leaves, he saw the same theme of perpendicularity, the same rush to the sky, repeated there. They did not tip over at the ends. Vast as they were, air was sufficient to support them so that the long aisles of the forest all rose to a kind of fan tracery. And the sawns, likewise, he shuddered as he thought it, they too were madly elongated. He had sufficient science to guess that he must be on a world lighter than Earth, where less strength was needed and nature was set free to follow her skyward impulse on a super-terrestrial scale. This set him wondering where he was. He could not remember whether Venus was larger or smaller than Earth, and he had an idea that she would be hotter than this. Perhaps he was on Mars, perhaps even on the Moon. The latter he at first rejected on the ground that, if it were so, he ought to have seen the Earth in the sky when they landed. But later he remembered having been told that one face of the Moon was always turned away from the Earth. For all he knew, he was wandering on the Moon's outer side. And, irrationally enough, this idea brought about him a bleaker sense of desolation than he had yet felt. Many of the gullies which he crossed now carried streams, blue hissing streams, all hastening to the lower ground on his left. Like the lake, they were warm, and the air was warm above them, so that as he climbed down and up the sides of the gullies, he was continually changing temperatures. It was the contrast, as he crested the farther bank of one such small ravine, which first drew his attention to the growing chilliness of the forest. And as he looked about him, he became certain that the light was failing too. He had not taken night into his calculations. He had no means of guessing what night might be on Malacandra. As he stood gazing into the deepening gloom, a sigh of cold wind crept through the purple stems and set them all a-swaying, revealing once again the startling contrast between their size and their apparent flexibility and lightness. Hunger and weariness, long kept at bay by the mingled fear and wonder of his situation, smote him suddenly. He shivered and forced himself to proceed. The wind increased. The mighty leaves danced and dipped above his head, admitting glimpses of a pale and then a paler sky, and then, discomfortingly, of a sky with one or two stars in it. The wood was no longer silent. His eyes darted hither and thither in search of an approaching enemy, and discovered only how quickly the darkness grew upon him. He welcomed the streams now for their warmth. It was this that first suggested to him a possible protection against the increasing cold. There was really no use in going farther. For all he knew, he might as well be walking towards danger as away from it. All was danger. He was no safer travelling than resting. Beside some stream it might be warm enough to lie. He shuffled on to find another gully, and went so far that he began to think he had got out of the region of them. He had almost determined to turn back when the ground began falling steeply. He slipped, recovered, and found himself on the bank of a torrent. The trees, for as trees he could not help regarding them, did not quite meet overhead, and the water itself seemed to have some faintly phosphorescent quality, so that it was lighter here. The fall from right to left was steep. Guided by some vague picnickers hankering for a better place, he went a few yards upstream. The valley grew steeper, and he came to a little cataract. He noticed dully that the water seemed to be descending a little too slowly for the incline, but he was too tired to speculate about it. The water was apparently hotter than that of the lake, perhaps nearer its subterranean source of heat. What he really wanted to know was whether he dared drink it. He was very thirsty by now, but it looked very poisonous, very unwatery. He would try not to drink it. Perhaps he was so tired that thirst would let him sleep. He sank on his knees and bathed his hands in the warm torrent. Then he rolled over in a hollow close beside the fall and yawned. The sound of his own voice yawning, the old sound heard in night nurseries, school dormitories, and in so many bedrooms, liberated a flood of self-pity. He drew his knees up and hugged himself. He felt a sort of physical, almost a filial, love for his own body. He put his wristwatch to his ear and found that it had stopped. He wound it. Muttering, half whimpering to himself, he thought of men going to bed on the far distant planet Earth. Men in clubs and liners and hotels, married men and small children who slept with nurses in the room, and warm, tobacco-smelling men tumbled together in forecastles and dugouts. The tendency to talk to himself was irresistible. "We'll look after you, Ransom. We'll stick together, old man." It occurred to him that one of those creatures with snapping jaws might live in the stream. "You're quite right, Ransom," he answered mumblingly. "It's not a safe place to spend the night. We'll just rest a bit till you feel better, then we'll go on again. Not now. Presently." Chapter 9. It was thirst that woke him. He had slept warm, though his clothes were damp, and found himself lying in sunlight, the blue waterfall at his side dancing and coruscating with every transparent shade in the whole gamut of blue, and flinging strange lights far up to the underside of the forest leaves. The realization of his position, as it rolled heavily back upon consciousness, was unbearable. If only he hadn't lost his nerve, the Sorns would have killed him by now. Then he remembered with inexpressible relief that there was a man wandering in the wood. Poor devil, he'd be glad to see him. He would come up to him and say, "Hello, Ransom." He stopped, puzzled. No, it was only himself. It was Ransom. Or was he? Who was the man whom he had led to a hot stream and tucked up in bed, telling him not to drink the strange water? Obviously, some newcomer who didn't know the place as well as he. But whatever Ransom had told him, he was going to drink now. He lay down on the bank and plunged his face in the warm, rushing liquid. It was good to drink. It had a strong mineral flavour, but it was very good. He drank again and found himself greatly refreshed and steadied. All that about the other Ransom was nonsense. He was quite aware of the danger of madness and applied himself vigorously to his devotions and his toilet. Not that madness mattered much. Perhaps he was mad already, and not really on Malacandra, but safe in bed in an English asylum. If only it might be so. He would ask Ransom. Curse it. There his mind went playing the same trick again. He rose and began walking briskly away. The delusions recurred every few minutes as long as this stage of his journey lasted. He learned to stand still, mentally, as it were, and let them roll over his mind. It was no good bothering about them. When they were gone, you could resume sanity again. Far more important was the problem of food. He tried one of the trees with his knife. As he expected, it was toughly soft like a vegetable, not hard like wood. He cut a little piece out of it, and under this operation, the whole gigantic organism vibrated to its top. It was like being able to shake the mast of a full-rigged ship with one hand. When he put it in his mouth, he found it almost tasteless, but by no means disagreeable, and for some minutes he munched away contentedly. But he made no progress. The stuff was quite unswallowable, and could only be used as chewing gum. As such, he used it, and after it many other pieces, and not without some comfort. It was impossible to continue yesterday's flight as a flight. Inevitably, it degenerated into an endless ramble, vaguely motivated by the search for food. The search was necessarily vague, since he did not know whether Malacandra held food for him, nor how to recognize it if it did. He had one bad fright in the course of the morning, when, passing through a somewhat more open glade, he became aware first of a huge yellow object, then of two, then of an indefinite multitude coming towards him. Before he could fly, he found himself in the midst of a herd of enormous, pale, furry creatures, more like giraffes than anything else he could think of, except that they could, and did, raise themselves on their hind legs, and even progress several paces in that position. They were slenderer and very much higher than giraffes, and were eating the leaves off the tops of the purple plants. They saw him and stared at him with their big liquid eyes, snorting in basso profondissimo, but had apparently no hostile intentions. Their appetite was voracious. In 5 minutes they had mutilated the tops of a few hundred trees and admitted a new flood of sunlight into the forest. Then they passed on. This episode had an infinitely comforting effect on Ransom. The planet was not, as he had begun to fear, lifeless except for Sorns. Here was a very presentable sort of animal, an animal which man could probably tame, and whose food man could possibly share. If only it were possible to climb the trees. He was staring about him with some idea of attempting this feat, when he noticed that the devastation wrought by the leaf-eating animals had opened a vista overhead beyond the plant tops to a collection of the same greenish-white objects which he had seen across the lake at their first landing. This time they were much closer. They were enormously high, so that he had to throw back his head to see the top of them. They were something like pylons in shape, but solid, irregular in height, and grouped in an apparently haphazard and disorderly fashion. Some ended in points that looked from where he stood as sharp as needles, while others, after narrowing towards the summit, expanded again into knobs or platforms that seemed to his terrestrial eyes ready to fall at any moment. He noticed that the sides were rougher and more seamed with fissures than he had realized at first, and between two of them he saw a motionless line of twisting blue brightness, obviously a distant fall of water. It was this which finally convinced him that the things, in spite of their improbable shape, were mountains. And with that discovery, the mere oddity of the prospect was swallowed up in the fantastic sublime. Here, he understood, was the full statement of that perpendicular theme which beast and plant and earth all played on Malacandra. Here, in this riot of rock, leaping and surging skyward like solid jets from some rock fountain, and hanging by their own lightness in the air, so shaped, so elongated, that all terrestrial mountains must ever after seem to him to be mountains lying on their sides. He felt a lift and lightening at the heart. But the next moment his heart stood still. Against the pallid background of the mountains, and quite close to him, for the mountains themselves seemed but a quarter of a mile away, a moving shape appeared. He recognized it instantly as it moved slowly, and, he thought, stealthily, between two of the denuded plant tops. The giant stature, the cadaverous leanness, the long, drooping, wizard-like profile of a Sorn. The head appeared to be narrow and conical. The hands or paws with which it parted the stems before it as it moved were thin, mobile, spidery, and almost transparent. He felt an immediate certainty that it was looking for him. All this he took in an infinitesimal time. The ineffaceable image was hardly stamped on his brain before he was running as hard as he could into the thickest of the forest. He had no plan save to put as many miles as he could between himself and the Sorn. He prayed fervently that there might be only one. Perhaps the wood was full of them. Perhaps they had the intelligence to make a circle round him. No matter. There was nothing for it now but sheer running, running knife in hand. The fear had all gone into action. Emotionally he was cool and alert, and ready as he ever would be, for the last trial. His flight led him downhill at an ever-increasing speed. Soon the incline was so steep that if his body had had terrestrial gravity, he would have been compelled to take to his hands and knees and clamber down. Then he saw something gleaming ahead of him. A minute later he had emerged from the wood altogether. He was standing, blinking in the light of sun and water, on the shore of a broad river, and looking out on a flat landscape of intermingled river, lake, island, and promontory, the same sort of country on which his eyes had first rested in Malacandra. There was no sound of pursuit. Ransom dropped down on his stomach and drank, cursing a world where cold water appeared to be unobtainable. Then he lay still to listen and to recover his breath. His eyes were upon the blue water. It was agitated. Circles shuddered and bubbles danced 10 yards away from his face. Suddenly the water heaved, and a round, shining black thing like a cannonball came into sight. Then he saw eyes and mouth, a puffing mouth bearded with bubbles. More of the thing came up out of the water. It was gleaming black. Finally it splashed and wallowed to the shore and rose, steaming, on its hind legs. 6 or 7 feet high, and too thin for its height, like everything in Malacandra. It had a coat of thick black hair, lucid as sealskin, very short legs with webbed feet, a broad beaver-like or fish-like tail, strong forelimbs with webbed claws or fingers, and some complication halfway up the belly which Ransom took to be its genitals. It was something like a penguin, something like an otter, something like a seal. The slenderness and flexibility of the body suggested a giant stoat. The great round head, heavily whiskered, was mainly responsible for the suggestion of seal, but it was higher in the forehead than a seal's, and the mouth was smaller. There comes a point at which the actions of fear and precaution are purely conventional, no longer felt as terror or hope by the fugitive. Ransom lay perfectly still, pressing his body as well down into the weed as he could, in obedience to a wholly theoretical idea that he might thus pass unobserved. He felt little emotion. He noted, in a dry, objective way, that this was apparently to be the end of his story, caught between a sorn from the land and a big black animal from the water. He had, it is true, a vague notion that the jaws and mouth of the beast were not those of a carnivore, but he knew that he was too ignorant of zoology to do more than guess. Then something happened which completely altered his state of mind. The creature, which was still steaming and shaking itself on the back and had obviously not seen him, opened its mouth and began to make noises. This in itself was not remarkable, but a lifetime of linguistic study assured Ransom almost at once that these were articulate noises. The creature was talking. It had a language. If you are not yourself a philologist, I am afraid you must take on trust the prodigious emotional consequences of this realization in Ransom's mind. A new world he had already seen, but a new, an extraterrestrial, a non-human language was a different matter. Somehow he had not thought of this in connection with the Sorns. Now it flashed upon him like a revelation. The love of knowledge is a kind of madness. In the fraction of a second which it took Ransom to decide that the creature was really talking, and while he still knew that he might be facing instant death, his imagination had leaped over every fear and hope and probability of his situation to follow the dazzling prospect of making a Malacandrian grammar. An introduction to the Malacandrian language, the lunar verb, a concise Martian English dictionary. The titles flitted through his mind. And what might one not discover from the speech of a non-human race? The very form of language itself, the principle behind all possible languages, might fall into his hands. Unconsciously he raised himself on his elbow and stared at the black beast. It became silent. The huge bullet head swung round and lustrous amber eyes fixed him. There was no wind on the lake or in the wood. Minute after minute, in utter silence, the representatives of two so far divided species stared each into the other's face. Ransom rose to his knees. The creature leaped back, watching him intently, and they became motionless again. Then it came a pace nearer, and Ransom jumped up and retreated, but not far. Curiosity held him. He summoned up his courage and advanced, holding out his hand. The beast misunderstood the gesture. It backed into the shallows of the lake, and he could see the muscles tightened under its sleek pelt, ready for sudden movement. But there it stopped. It, too, was in the grip of curiosity. Neither dared let the other approach, yet each repeatedly felt the impulse to do so himself, and yielded to it. It was foolish, frightening, ecstatic, and unbearable all in one moment. It was more than curiosity. It was like a courtship, like the meeting of the first man and the first woman in the world. It was like something beyond that. So natural is the contact of sexes, so limited the strangeness, so shallow the reticence, so mild the repugnance to be overcome, compared with the first tingling intercourse of two different but rational species. The creature suddenly turned and began walking away. A disappointment like despair smote Ransom. "Come back!" he shouted in English. The thing turned, spread out its arms, and spoke again in its unintelligible language. Then it resumed its progress. It had not gone more than 20 yards away when Ransom saw it stoop down and pick something up. It returned. In its hand, he was already thinking of its webbed forepaw as a hand, it was carrying what appeared to be a shell, the shell of some oyster-like creature, but rounder and more deeply domed. It dipped the shell in the lake and raised it full of water. Then it held the shell to its own middle and seemed to be pouring something into the water. Ransom thought with disgust that it was urinating in the shell. Then he realized that the protuberances on the creature's belly were not genital organs, nor organs at all. It was wearing a kind of girdle hung with various pouch-like objects, and it was adding a few drops of liquid from one of these to the water in the shell. This done, it raised the shell to its black lips and drank, not throwing back its head like a man, but bowing it and sucking like a horse. When it had finished, it refilled the shell and once again added a few drops from the receptacle. It seemed to be some kind of skin bottle at its waist. Supporting the shell in its two arms, it extended them towards Ransom. The intention was unmistakable. Hesitantly, almost shyly, he advanced and took the cup. His fingertips touched the webbed membrane of the creature's paws, and an indescribable thrill of mingled attraction and repulsion ran through him. Then he drank. Whatever had been added to the water was plainly alcoholic. He had never enjoyed a drink so much. "Thank you," he said in English. "Thank you very much." The creature struck itself on the chest and made a noise. Ransom did not at first realize what it meant. Then he saw that it was trying to teach him its name, presumably the name of the species.
"Hross," it said. "Hross,"
and flapped itself.
"Hross,"
repeated Ransom, and pointed at it. Then "man," and struck his own chest.
"Hma, hma, hman,"
imitated the hross. It picked up a handful of earth, where earth appeared between weed and water at the bank of the lake.
"Chandra,"
it said. Ransom repeated the word. Then an idea occurred to him.
"Malakandra,"
he said in an inquiring voice. The hross rolled its eyes and waved its arms, obviously in an effort to indicate the whole landscape. Ransom was getting on well. Chandra was earth, the element. Malakandra, the earth or planet as a whole. Soon he would find out what Malak meant. In the meantime, H disappears after C, he noted, and made his first step in Malakandrian phonetics. The hross was now trying to teach him the meaning of Handramit. He recognized the root Handra again, and noted they have suffixes as well as prefixes. But this time he could make nothing of the hross's gestures, and remained ignorant what a Handramit might be. He took the initiative by opening his mouth, pointing to it, and going through the pantomime of eating. The Malakandrian word for food, or eat, which he got in return, proved to contain consonants unreproducible by a human mouth, and Ransom, continuing the pantomime, tried to explain that his interest was practical as well as philological. The cross understood him, though he took some time to understand from its gestures that it was inviting him to follow it. In the end, he did so. It took him only as far as where it had got the shell, and here, to his not very reasonable astonishment, Ransom found that a kind of boat was moored. Manlike, when he saw the artifact, he felt more certain of the cross's rationality. He even valued the creature the more because the boat, allowing for the usual Malakandrian height and flimsiness, was really very like an earthly boat. Only later did he set himself the question, what else could a boat be like? The cross produced an oval platter of some tough but slightly flexible material, covered it with strips of spongy, orange-coloured substance, and gave it to Ransom. He cut a convenient length off with his knife and began to eat, doubtfully at first, and then ravenously. It had a bean-like taste, but sweeter. Good enough for a starving man. Then, as his hunger ebbed, the sense of his situation returned with dismaying force. The huge, seal-like creature seated beside him became unbearably ominous. It seemed friendly, but it was very big, very black, and he knew nothing at all about it. What were its relations to the Sorns, and was it really as rational as it appeared? It was only many days later that Ransom discovered how to deal with these sudden losses of confidence. They arose when the rationality of the cross tempted you to think of it as a man. Then it became abominable. A man 7 feet high, with a snaky body, covered face and all with thick black animal hair, and whiskered like a cat. But starting from the other end, you had an animal with everything an animal ought to have. Glossy coat, liquid eyes, sweet breath, and whitest teeth. And added to all these, as though paradise had never been lost and earliest dreams were true, the charm of speech and reason. Nothing could be more disgusting than the one impression, nothing more delightful than the other. It all depended on the point of view. Chapter 10. When Ransom had finished his meal and drunk again of the strong waters of Malakandra, his host rose and entered the boat. He did this head first, like an animal, his sinuous body allowing him to rest his hands on the bottom of the boat while his feet were still planted on the land. He completed the operation by flinging rump, tail, and hind legs all together about 5 feet into the air, and then whisking them neatly on board, with an agility which would have been quite impossible to an animal of his bulk on earth. Having got into the boat, he proceeded to get out again, and then pointed to it. Ransom understood that he was being invited to follow his example. The question which he wanted to ask above all others could not, of course, be put. Were the Hrossa? He discovered later that this was the plural of Hross, the dominant species on Malacandra, and the Sorns, despite their more man-like shape, merely a semi-intelligent kind of cattle. Fervently he hoped that it might be so. On the other hand, the Hrossa might be the domestic animals of the Sorns, in which case the latter would be super-intelligent. His whole imaginative training somehow encouraged him to associate superhuman intelligence with monstrosity of form and ruthlessness of will. To step on board the Hross's boat might mean surrendering himself to Sorns at the other end of the journey. On the other hand, the Hross's invitation might be a golden opportunity of leaving the Sorn-haunted forests forever. And by this time the Hross itself was becoming puzzled at his apparent inability to understand it. The urgency of its signs finally determined him. The thought of parting from the Hross could not be seriously entertained. Its animality shocked him in a dozen ways, but his longing to learn its language, and, deeper still, the shy, ineluctable fascination of unlike for unlike, the sense that the key to prodigious adventure was being put in his hands, all this had really attached him to it by bonds stronger than he knew. He stepped into the boat. The boat was without seats. It had a very high prow, an enormous expanse of freeboard, and what seemed to Ransom an impossibly shallow draught. Indeed, very little of it even rested on the water. He was reminded of a modern European speedboat. It was moored by something that looked at first like rope, but the Hross cast off not by untying, but by simply pulling the apparent rope in two, as one might pull in two a piece of soft toffee or a roll of plasticine. It then squatted down on its rump in the stern sheets and took up a paddle, a paddle of such enormous blade that Ransom wondered how the creature could wield it, till he again remembered how light a planet they were on. The length of the Hross's body enabled him to work freely in the squatting position, despite the high gunwale. It paddled quickly. For the first few minutes they passed between banks wooded with the purple trees, upon a waterway not more than 100 yards in width. Then they doubled a promontory, and Ransom saw that they were emerging onto a much larger sheet of water, a great lake, almost a sea. The Hross, now taking great care and often changing direction and looking about it, paddled well out from the shore. The dazzling blue expanse grew moment by moment wider around them. Ransom could not look steadily at it. The warmth from the water was oppressive. He removed his cap and jerkin, and by so doing surprised the Hross very much. He rose cautiously to a standing position and surveyed the Malacandrian prospect which had opened on every side. Before and behind them lay the glittering lake, here studded with islands, and there smiling interruptedly at the pale blue sky. The sun, he noticed, was almost immediately overhead. They were in the Malacandrian tropics. At each end the lake vanished into more complicated groupings of land and water, softly, featherily embossed in the purple giant weed. But this marshy land, or chain of archipelagos, as he now beheld it, was bordered on each side with jagged walls of the pale grey mountains, which he could still hardly call mountains, so tall they were, so gaunt, sharp, narrow, and seemingly unbalanced. On the starboard they were not more than a mile away, and seemed divided from the water only by a narrow strip of forest. To the left they were far more distant, though still impressive, perhaps 7 miles from the boat. They ran on each side of the watered country as far as he could see, both onwards and behind them. He was sailing, in fact, on the flooded floor of a majestic canyon nearly 10 miles wide and of unknown length. Behind, and sometimes above the mountain peaks, he could make out in many places great billowy piles of the rose-red substance which he had yesterday mistaken for cloud. The mountains, in fact, seemed to have no fall of ground behind them. They were rather the serrated bastion of immeasurable tablelands, higher in many places than themselves, which made the Malacandrian horizon left and right as far as eye could reach. Only straight ahead and straight astern was the planet cut with the vast gorge, which now appeared to him only as a rut or crack in the tableland. He wondered what the cloud-like red masses were, and endeavoured to ask by signs. The question was, however, too particular for sign language. The cross, with a wealth of gesticulation, its arms or forelimbs were more flexible than his, and in quick motion, almost whip-like, made it clear that it supposed him to be asking about the high ground in general. It named this Harandra. The low-watered country, the gorge or canyon, appeared to be Handramit. Ransom grasped the implications. Handra, earth. Harandra, high earth, mountain. Handramit, low earth, valley. Highland and lowland, in fact. The peculiar importance of the distinction in Malakandrian geography he learned later. By this time the Hross had attained the end of its careful navigation. They were a couple of miles from land when it suddenly ceased paddling and sat tense with its paddle poised in the air. At the same moment the boat quivered and shot forward as if from a catapult. They had apparently availed themselves of some current. In a few seconds they were racing forward at some 15 miles an hour and rising and falling on the strange, sharp, perpendicular waves of Malakandra with a jerky motion quite unlike that of the choppiest sea that Ransom had ever met on earth. It reminded him of disastrous experiences on a trotting horse in the army, and it was intensely disagreeable. He gripped the gunwale with his left hand and mopped his brow with his right. The damp warmth from the water had become very troublesome. He wondered if the Malakandrian food, and still more the Malakandrian drink, were really digestible by a human stomach. Thank heaven he was a good sailor. At least a fairly good sailor. At least. Hastily he leaned over the side. Heat from blue water smote up to his face. In the depth he thought he saw eels playing, long, silver eels. The worst happened not once, but many times. In his misery he remembered vividly the shame of being sick at a children's party, long ago in the star where he was born. He felt a similar shame now. It was not thus that the first representative of humanity would choose to appear before a new species. Did Hrossa vomit too? Would it know what he was doing? Shaking and groaning, he turned back into the boat. The creature was keeping an eye on him, but its face seemed to him expressionless. It was only long after that he learned to read the Malakandrian face. The current, meanwhile, seemed to be gathering speed. In a huge curve they swung across the lake to within a furlong of the farther shore, then back again, and once more onward, in giddy spirals and figures of eight, while purple wood and jagged mountain raced backwards, and Ransom loathingly associated their sinuous course with the nauseous curling of the silver eels. He was rapidly losing all interest in Malakandra. The distinction between Earth and other planets seemed of no importance compared with the awful distinction of Earth and water. He wondered despairingly whether the Hross habitually lived on water. Perhaps they were going to spend the night in this detestable boat. His sufferings did not, in fact, last long. There came a blessed cessation of the choppy movement and a slackening of speed, and he saw that the Hross was backing water rapidly. They were still afloat, with shores close on each side. Between them a narrow channel in which the water hissed furiously, apparently a shallow. The Hross jumped overboard, splashing abundance of warm water into the ship. Ransom, more cautiously and shakily, clambered after it. He was about up to his knees. To his astonishment, the Hross, without any appearance of effort, lifted the boat bodily onto the top of its head, steadied it with one forepaw, and proceeded, erect as a Grecian caryatid, to the land. They walked forward, if the swinging movement of the horse's short legs from its flexible hips could be called walking, beside the channel. In a few minutes Ransom saw a new landscape. The channel was not only a shallow, but a rapid, the first indeed of a series of rapids by which the water descended steeply for the next half mile. The ground fell away before them, and the canyon, or Handramit, continued at a very much lower level. Its walls, however, did not sink with it. And from his present position, Ransom got a clearer notion of the lie of the land. Far more of the highlands to left and right were visible, sometimes covered with the cloud-like red swellings, but more often level, pale and barren, to where the smooth line of their horizon marched with the sky. The mountain peaks now appeared only as the fringe or border of the true highland, surrounding it as the lower teeth surround the tongue. He was struck by the vivid contrast between Harandra and Handramit. Like a rope of jewels the gorge spread beneath him, purple, sapphire blue, yellow and pinkish white, a rich and variegated inlay of wooded land and disappearing, reappearing, ubiquitous water. Malakandra was less like earth than he had been beginning to suppose. The Hadhramit was no true valley, rising and falling with the mountain chain it belonged to. Indeed, it did not belong to a mountain chain. It was only an enormous crack or ditch of varying depth running through the high and level Harandra. The latter, he now began to suspect, was the true surface of the planet. Certainly would appear as surface to a terrestrial astronomer. To the Hadhramit itself there seemed no end. Uninterrupted and very nearly straight, it ran before him, a narrowing line of colour, to where it clove the horizon with a V-shaped indenture. There must be 100 miles of it in view, he thought, and he reckoned that he had put some 30 or 40 miles of it behind him since yesterday. All this time they were descending beside the rapids to where the water was level again, and the Hross could relaunch its skiff. During this walk, Ransom learned the words for boat, rapid, water, sun, and carry. The latter, as his first verb, interested him particularly. The Hross was also at some pains to impress upon him an association or relation which it tried to convey by repeating the contrasted pairs of words Hrossa Hadhramit and Saroni Harandra. Ransom understood him to mean that the Hrossa lived down in the Hadhramit and the Saroni up on the Harandra. What the deuce were Saroni, he wondered. The open reaches of the Harandra did not look as if anything lived up there. Perhaps the Hrossa had a mythology. He took it for granted they were on a low cultural level, and the Saroni were gods or demons. The journey continued with frequent, though decreasing, recurrences of nausea for Ransom. Hours later he realized that Saroni might very well be the plural of Sorn. The sun declined on their right. It dropped quicker than on Earth, or at least on those parts of Earth that Ransom knew, and in the cloudless sky it had little sunset pomp about it. In some other queer way, which he could not specify, it differed from the sun he knew. But even while he speculated, the needle-like mountain top stood out black against it, and the Hadhramit grew dark, though eastward, to their left, the high country of the Harandra still shone pale rose, remote and smooth and tranquil, like another and more spiritual world. Soon he became aware that they were landing again, that they were treading solid ground, were making for the depth of the purple forest. The motion of the boat still worked in his fantasy, and the earth seemed to sway beneath him. This, with weariness and twilight, made the rest of the journey dreamlike. Light began to glare in his eyes. A fire was burning. It illuminated the huge leaves overhead, and he saw stars beyond them. Dozens of Hrossa seemed to have surrounded him, more animal, less human in their multitude and their close neighbourhood to him than his solitary guide had seemed. He felt some fear, but more a ghastly inappropriateness. He wanted men, any men, even Western and Divine. He was too tired to do anything about these meaningless bullet heads and furry faces, could make no response at all. And then, lower down, closer to him, more mobile, came in throngs the whelps, the puppies, the cubs, whatever you called them. Suddenly his mood changed. They were jolly little things. He laid his hands on one black head and smiled. The creature scurried away. He never could remember much of that evening. There was more eating and drinking. There was continual coming and going of black forms. There were strange eyes luminous in the firelight. Finally, there was sleep in some dark, apparently covered place.
Chapter 11. Ever since he awoke on the spaceship, Ransom had been thinking about the amazing adventure of going to another planet, and about his chances of returning from it. What he had not thought about was being on it. It was with a kind of stupefaction each morning that he found himself neither arriving in nor escaping from, but simply living on Malakandra, waking, sleeping, eating, swimming, and even, as the days passed, talking. The wonder of it smote him most strongly when he found himself, about 3 weeks after his arrival, actually going for a walk. A few weeks later he had his favourite walks and his favourite foods. He was beginning to develop habits. He knew a male from a female Hross at sight, and even individual differences were becoming plain. Hyoi, who had first found him, miles away to the north, was a very different person from the grey-muzzled, venerable Hnora, who was daily teaching him the language. And the young of the species were different again. They were delightful. You could forget all about the rationality of Hrossa in dealing with them. Too young to trouble him with the baffling enigma of reason in an inhuman form, they solaced his loneliness, as if he had been allowed to bring a few dogs with him from the earth.
The cubs, on their part, felt the liveliest interest in the hairless goblin which had appeared among them. With them, and therefore indirectly with their dams, he was a brilliant success. Of the community in general, his earlier impressions were all gradually being corrected. His first diagnosis of their culture was what he called Old Stone Age. The few cutting instruments they possessed were made of stone. They seemed to have no pottery, but a few clumsy vessels used for boiling, and boiling was the only cookery they attempted. Their common drink vessel, dish, and ladle, all in one, was the oyster-like shell in which he had first tasted Hross hospitality. The fish which it contained was their only animal food. Vegetable fare they had in great plenty and variety, some of it delicious. Even the pinkish-white weed which covered the whole Hadramit was edible at a pinch, so that if he had starved before Hioi found him, he would have starved amidst abundance. No Hross, however, ate the weed, Honodrascrud for choice, though it might be used faute de mieux on a journey. Their dwellings were beehive-shaped huts of stiff leaf, and the villages, there were several in the neighbourhood, were always built beside rivers for warmth, and well upstream towards the walls of the Hadramit, where the water was hottest. They slept on the ground. They seemed to have no arts except a kind of poetry and music, which was practised almost every evening by a team or troop of four Hrossa. One recited half-chanting at great length, while the other three, sometimes singly and sometimes antiphonally, interrupted him from time to time with song. Ransom could not find out whether these interruptions were simply lyrical interludes or dramatic dialogue arising out of the leader's narrative. He could make nothing of the music. The voices were not disagreeable, and the scale seemed adapted to human ears. But the time pattern was meaningless to his sense of rhythm. The occupations of the tribe or family were at first mysterious. People were always disappearing for a few days and reappearing again. There was a little fishing and much journeying in boats, of which he never discovered the object. Then one day he saw a kind of caravan of Hrossa setting out by land, each with a load of vegetable food on its head. Apparently there was some kind of trade in Malacandra. He discovered their agriculture in the first week. About a mile down the Hadramit, one came to broad lands free of forest and clothed for many miles together in low pulpy vegetation, in which yellow, orange, and blue predominated. Later on there were lettuce-like plants about the height of a terrestrial birch tree. Where one of these overhung the warmth of the water, you could step into one of the lower leaves and lie deliciously as in a gently moving, fragrant hammock. Elsewhere it was not warm enough to sit still for long out of doors. The general temperature of the Hadramit was that of a fine winter's morning on earth. These food-producing areas were worked communally by the surrounding villages, and division of labour had been carried to a higher point than he expected. Cutting, drying, storing, transport, and something like manuring were all carried on, and he suspected that some, at least, of the water channels were artificial. But the real revolution in his understanding of the Hrossa began when he had learned enough of their language to attempt some satisfaction of their curiosity about himself. In answer to their questions, he began by saying that he had come out of the sky. Hnora immediately asked from which planet or earth, Hadra. Ransom, who had deliberately given a childish version of the truth in order to adapt it to the supposed ignorance of his audience, was a little annoyed to find Nora painfully explaining to him that he could not live in the sky because there was no air in it. He might have come through the sky, but he must have come from a Hadra. He was quite unable to point Earth out to them in the night sky. They seemed surprised at his inability, and repeatedly pointed out to him a bright planet low on the western horizon, a little south of where the sun had gone down. He was surprised that they selected a planet instead of a mere star, and stuck to their choice. Could it be possible that they understood astronomy? Unfortunately, he still knew too little of the language to explore their knowledge. He turned the conversation by asking them the name of the bright southern planet, and was told that it was Thulkandra, the silent world or planet. "Why do you call it Thulk?" he asked. "Why silent?" No one knew. "The Saroni know," said Nora. "That is the sort of thing they know." Then he was asked how he had come, and made a very poor attempt at describing the spaceship, but again, the Saroni would know. Had he come alone? No, he had come with two others of his kind, bad men. Bent men was the nearest Hrossian equivalent, who tried to kill him, but he had run away from them. The Hrossa found this very difficult, but all finally agreed that he ought to go to Oyarsa. Oyarsa would protect him. Ransom asked who Oyarsa was. Slowly and with many misunderstandings, he hammered out the information that Oyarsa, 1, lived at Meldilorn, 2, knew everything and ruled everyone, 3, had always been there, and 4, was not a Hross nor one of the Saroni. Then Ransom, following his own idea, asked if Oyarsa had made the world. The Hrossa almost barked in the fervor of their denial.
Did people in Tholkandra not know that Mereldil the Young had made and still ruled the world? Even a child knew that. Where did Mereldil live? Ransom asked.
With the Old One.
And who was the Old One? Ransom did not understand the answer. He tried again. Where was the Old One?
He is not that sort, said Nora, that he has to live anywhere, and proceeded to a good deal which Ransom did not follow. But he followed enough to feel once more a certain irritation. Ever since he had discovered the rationality of the Hrossa, he had been haunted by a conscientious scruple as to whether it might not be his duty to undertake their religious instruction. Now, as a result of his tentative efforts, he found himself being treated as if he were the savage, and being given a first sketch of civilized religion, a sort of Hrossian equivalent of the shorter catechism. It became plain that Mereldil was a spirit without body, parts, or passions.
"He is not Hnau," said the Hrossa.
"What is Hnau?" asked Ransom.
"You are Hnau. I am Hnau. The Saroni are Hnau. The Pfiffeltrigi are Hnau."
"Pfiffeltrigi?" said Ransom.
"More than 10 days' journey to the west," said Nora, "the Harandra sinks down not into a Hadramit, but into a broad place, an open place, spreading every way. 5 days' journey from the north to the south of it, 10 days' journey from the east to the west.
The forests are of other colours there than here. They are blue and green. It is very deep there. It goes to the roots of the world. The best things that can be dug out of the earth are there. The Pfiffeltrigi live there. They delight in digging. What they dig they soften with fire and make things of it.
They are little people, smaller than you, long in the snout, pale, busy. They have long limbs in front. No Hnau can match them in making and shaping things, as none can match us in singing. But let Man see." He turned and spoke to one of the younger Hrossa, and presently, passed from hand to hand, there came to him a little bowl. He held it close to the firelight and examined it. It was certainly of gold, and Ransom realized the meaning of Divine's interest in Malakandra.
"Is there much of this thing?" he asked.
"Yes," he was told. "It was washed down in most of the rivers, but the best and most was among the Pfiffeltrigi, and it was they who were skilled in it. Arbol Hru, they called it. Sun's blood." He looked at the bowl again. It was covered with fine etching. He saw pictures of Hrossa and of smaller, almost frog-like animals, and then of Sorns. He pointed to the latter inquiringly.
"Saroni," said the Hrossa, confirming his suspicions. "They live up almost on the Harandra, in the big caves."
The frog-like animals, or tapir-headed, frog-bodied animals, were Pfiffeltrigi. Ransom turned it over in his mind. On Malakandra, apparently, 3 distinct species had reached rationality, and none of them had yet exterminated the other 2. It concerned him intensely to find out which was the real master.
"Which of the Hnau rule?" he asked.
"Oyarsa rules," was the reply.
"Is he Hnau?"
This puzzled them a little. The Saroni, they thought, would be better at that kind of question. Perhaps Oyarsa was Hnau, but a very different Hnau. He had no death and no young.
"These Saroni no more than the Hrossa?" asked Ransom.
This produced more a debate than an answer. What emerged finally was the Saroni, or Sorns, were perfectly helpless in a boat, and could not fish to save their lives, could hardly swim, could make no poetry, and even when Hrossa had made it for them, could understand only the inferior sorts. But they were admittedly good at finding out things about the stars, and understanding the darker utterances of Oyarsa, and telling what happened in Malakandra longer ago than anyone could remember.
"Ah, the intelligentsia," thought Ransom. "They must be the real rulers, however it is disguised."
He tried to ask what would happen if the Sorns used their wisdom to make the Hrossa do things. This was as far as he could get in his halting Malakandrian.
The question did not sound nearly so urgent in this form as it would have done if he had been able to, say, used their scientific resources for the exploitation of their uncivilized neighbors. But he might have spared his pains. The mention of the Sorn's inadequate appreciation of poetry had diverted the whole conversation into literary channels. Of the heated and apparently technical discussion which followed, he understood not a syllable. Naturally, his conversations with the Hrossa did not all turn on Malakandra. He had to repay them with information about Earth. He was hampered in this both by the humiliating discoveries which he was constantly making of his own ignorance about his native planet, and partly by his determination to conceal some of the truth. He did not want to tell them too much of our human wars and industrialisms. He remembered how H.G. Wells' Cavour had met his end on the moon. Also, he felt shy. A sensation akin to that of physical nakedness came over him whenever they questioned him too closely about men, the Khmana, as they called them. Moreover, he was determined not to let them know that he had been brought there to be given to the Sorns, for he was becoming daily more certain that these were the dominant species. What he did tell them fired the imagination of the Hrossa. They all began making poems about the strange Hundra, where the plants were hard like stone, and the earthweed green like rock, and the waters cold and salt. And Mana lived out on top, on the Harandra. They were even more interested in what he had to tell them of the aquatic animal with snapping jaws, which he had fled from in their own world, and even in their own Hundramit. It was a Hnakra, they all agreed. They were intensely excited. There had not been a Hnakra in the valley for many years. The youth of the Hrossa got out their weapons, primitive harpoons with points of bone, and the very cubs began playing at Hnakra hunting in the shallows. Some of the mothers showed signs of anxiety and wanted the cubs to be kept out of the water. But in general, the news of the Hnakra seemed to be immensely popular. Hyoi set off at once to do something to his boat, and Ransom accompanied him. He wished to make himself useful and was already beginning to have some vague capacity with the primitive Hrossian tools. They walked together to Hyoi's creek, a stone's throw through the forest. On the way, where the path was single and Ransom was following Hyoi, they passed a little she-hross, not much more than a cub. She spoke as they passed, but not to them. Her eyes were on a spot about 5 yards away. "Who do you speak to, Hriki?" said Ransom. "To the Eldil." "Where?" "Did you not see him?" "I saw nothing." "There, there!" she cried suddenly. "Ah! He is gone. Did you not see him?" "I saw no one." "Hyoi," said the cub, "the man cannot see the Eldil." But Hyoi, continuing steadily on his way, was already out of earshot, and had apparently was pretending, like the young of his own species. In a few moments he rejoined his companion.